Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The United States had a plan for dealing with pandemics. Government officials developed that plan under President Obama because scientists knew that we would eventually face that reality and they didn't want to be caught flat-footed. But during the COVID-19 outbreak, the Trump administration chose to ignore that plan. The result was a lethal bungling of the outbreak with mixed messages, a lot of playing catch-up, tons of mis- and disinformation, and hundreds of thousands of deaths, many of them unnecessary. But there was another component to our inadequate initial response. Social problems, from economic inequality, privileging those who can work from home, to systemic racism, causing people of color in this country to lead shorter, sicker lives, to a less-than-comprehensive social safety net. Those things are addressed in a new book that also lays out some suggestions for how to avoid a repeat of what happened during COVID when the next pandemic comes along, and it will. The book is called The Contagion Next Time. It's by our guest for the hour, Sandro Galea. He's a physician, epidemiologist, dean of, and the Robert Knox Professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. Thank you for being here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
In the introduction to your book, you say that COVID-19 was a global crisis and preventing pandemics is ultimately a global responsibility. So let's start there. Two questions. First, how would you compare this country's response to the response to this virus when it initially happened and to what we're doing now around the rest of the world?
Well, let's start with the bad news. The bad news is I don't think that any one country covered itself in glory in dealing with this pandemic. And we learned as a world that we were vastly unprepared, unprepared conceptually and unprepared logistically for dealing with a pandemic like this. However, the United States was a particular case. The pandemic hit in March of 2020, hit this country anyway. And it was at the beginning of an election, a presidential election year. The president at the time decided that the pandemic was what was going to determine whether he gets reelected or not. And right from the very first moments of us seeing the pandemic, everything that we did was refracted through the lens of partisan politics. And unfortunately, that set us down on a particular path. And I don't say this in a way as in critical of one party or another. I'm simply saying that it came at a moment where everything we did, if you wear a mask or you do not, if you're supportive of vaccines or you do not, it became partisan, which is, of course, foolish. And I think when we step away from ourselves, we can all realize that is simply not the right way of handling the pandemic. So we had the pandemic hit at a time of fairly unique national division, where the pandemic fueled those divisions and was fueled by them. And that's really unfortunate. And it's hard to think of other countries that had that perfect storm. Of course, we've done worse than all other countries, which should tell us something.
As a medical doctor, as an epidemiologist, as somebody who has worked on contagion plans and understands thoroughly what pandemics mean and how they spread and how they unfold and how we get them under control. Did it surprise you that this became so political in this country?
It did. I'm not sure that I ever expected something like this to become so political. I've written and others have written, but of course we will face pandemics. I mean, human beings have faced pandemics on a regular basis for hundreds of thousands of years, really. So there was nothing particularly surprising that we faced a pandemic, but the way we experienced it and lived through it through this lens of politics where the pandemic itself was inseparable from economic, political, social considerations, that was a surprise. And it certainly opened my eyes, and I think it's opened the eyes of many of us, that you cannot think of a pandemic as an epidemiological, biological phenomenon. You have to think of a pandemic as a social and economic phenomenon.
Which is, I guess, the basis of your book, which we'll talk about.
It is essentially.
Yeah, essentially. But I'm going to get back to this idea that you start the book with, that it was a global pandemic and that getting a handle on it is a global responsibility. So my question about that, second question about that, is that since it is global, do we have to, and these variants crop up in various parts of the world, and the virus came here from elsewhere around the world, and I'm sure that Americans took it to other countries that we don't even think about in their travels. Do we need, in this world of air travel, when a new virus comes along or a new pathogen comes along, do we need to rethink how we handle international travel and opening and closing of borders if we really want to get a handle on a global situation?
I do think we need to rethink, but perhaps what comes after the thought is different than when your question was leading. I'm not sure that rethinking means necessarily closing borders. We as a world have had a long-standing reasonable reluctance to close borders when there are pandemics because it stops the flow of aid, stops the flow of needed commerce between countries, and really arrests the whole global system. So when the pandemic hit, we were in that mindset. And as a result, there were relatively few border closures early in the pandemic. Now, of course, with this pandemic, we saw that there actually was some wisdom to closing borders at particular moments in time. And of course, that also became politicized. And we saw it in the last presidential election that it became an issue of contention as to when borders were closed and when borders were not. But leaving the politics out of it, I think there is a moment in time when border closures make sense. But there are other moments in time when border closures are an overreaction. You know, we're living through border closures right now. I know in part that's why you're asking, because with the Omicron variant, we saw this rapid closure of borders for African countries. But I'm not sure that there's any indication for that right now. I'm not sure that we know enough about the Omicron variant to affect border closures that are, again, dramatic, a dramatic reaction. They really stop the flow of people, the flow of goods in a way like nothing else does. We did not close borders when Delta was going on in Europe. And there's a question whether we should have done it then or not. The bottom line is, I think the issue of border closures is a really complicated question. And I do not think that we have had the wisdom and perhaps the presence of mind to really discuss it in a rational way during this pandemic. And one of the things I'm looking forward to is when the pandemic is over, is for us to look back and say now, what did we learn? What did we learn about border closures? And how do we establish principles for when border closures make sense for a future pandemic?
Although I think they're still working on figuring out exactly where this virus came from. We know it probably came from someplace in China, whether it escaped from a lab or not, we don't know. But we do know that it came here from another country. We know that the variants that you've spoken of, the Delta and the Omicron variant and probably others, I think, came here from other countries. Are there incidences of variants developing here and then going elsewhere from the United States? And if not, why not?
Oh, I'm sure there are. But what we have to remember is that most variants end up being benign and go away. So a variant simply is a change in genetic code of the virus. And these viruses change genetic codes fairly frequently. So I'm sure there have been variants that have emerged here, that have gone elsewhere, which we haven't heard about just because they haven't become dominant. You know, you mentioned Delta and Omicron, and these are the two that we hear about because they've become widespread. But there have been Iota and Tau. These also have been variants that have emerged, and they just have fizzled out. They did not become dominant variants that have affected many people. Why there hasn't been something that has emerged from this country? It's simply luck. It's simply that there has been no particular variant that has taken hold that emerged from the U.S., but there's no reason why one would not emerge here.
We are dealing with this virus. We've been dealing with it now for 2 years, and people are really tired of this. And I think that's because they haven't really experienced anything like this in their lifetime. We've heard about outbreaks of various different viruses around the world wreaking havoc on populations, but they've been localized. They haven't spread around the globe like this one. Put this one into some sort of perspective. I guess it spreads more easily because it is a respiratory virus, and it spreads through particles that come from breathing in and out. But is this something that we're going to have to live with forevermore, this virus and variants of it?
This virus will probably stay with us in some form or another. It will go from being pandemic to becoming endemic. And endemic simply means that there is a baseline rate. There's a rate at which the virus exists with us and we become accustomed to it. Now, to talk about this virus as to why this one, I think in this country, we have had a bit of a illusion that we're not going to have a pandemic because things like SARS, for example, hit Hong Kong, hit Toronto, Canada, but they really didn't come to the US. But frankly, that was just luck. It was just luck of how that particular virus spread. This virus spread worldwide for a couple of reasons. Number one is its respiratory transmission, which, as you say, is an easy mode of transmitting the virus because different people in proximity can transmit it to one another easily. And the other feature that made it so widespread is that it's actually not that lethal. Now, I know the concern has been about death from the virus, and of course, about almost 800,000 Americans have now died from the virus, but per person who would have infected is maybe 1% lethality. SARS, by way of example, was about 10%. When a virus is more lethal, it doesn't spread as well because it's killing its hosts. When a virus is less lethal, it finds hosts, which is us people. It lives in people, and it's more easy to transmit.
So are those people who are opposed to shutdowns, opposed to mask wearing, opposed to getting vaccinated, are they right when they advocate for letting this virus spread and achieving herd immunity?
Well, those are three very different things because you mentioned shutdowns, masks, and vaccines.
Well, yeah.
So let's talk about each of them because they all do very different things. So what shutdowns and lockdowns do is they try to isolate people. They try to isolate us so that recognizing that this is respiratory transmission and saying, Mike, if you and I are in different states, then we can't transmit virus to each other. The real downside of shutdowns and lockdowns is that it shuts down the economy. And shutting down the economy tends to affect principally people who are already in low-wage jobs or who do not have the wealth and the resources to buffer them through those shutdowns. Those are the shutdowns. Mask wearing aims to reduce the viral load that we transmit to each other. So mask wearing allows us to continue operating as a society, but reduces the risk of person-to-person transmission. Vaccines are effective and safe, and they are really the ultimate form of protection from transmission. So, to my mind, we have to be very careful about not mixing what each of these different approaches do because they have very different downsides.
But if the lethality of this virus is not all it's cracked up to be, if it's only, I think you said 1% as opposed to 10%, do we really need to, if you're really opposed to vaccines, do we really need to get the vaccine because of the low chance of death, even though it's killed so many people around the world?
Yeah, so then the question becomes, who is the virus killing and are we protected the people who are most at risk from the virus? So we know that if you're over 65 or you have underlying disease, things like hypertension, heart disease, lung disease, those are the people mostly who get severe virus. Now, the argument that one hears against vaccines is, well, I'm a young, healthy 35-year-old. I'm unlikely to get sick. Then why do I need a vaccine? The counter to that is that it is true that you're unlikely to get sick, but if you're exposed to the virus, you can then pass it on to somebody around you who is over 65 or who has underlying disease. So you, by becoming an unwitting host, even if it's not affecting you very much, you are resulting in virus continuing to circulate and continue to affect people who are sick, who are sicker or older than you. So that's the argument against non-vaccine. But let's talk a little bit about herd immunity. You brought it up. Herd immunity, which essentially means enough people who have been infected by the virus that they're no longer susceptible, is certainly one way in which viruses stop spreading. The question for us is, what's the human cost of herd immunity? What's the cost of letting the virus stop spreading? Now, quickly you realize that this gets to be a very complicated question, because what if we were very good at protecting people who are over 65 and who have underlying disease, but allowed only young people to be exposed to the virus? In theory, you can see how that could be a strategy, right? If we were to say, look, people between the age of and 45, they get the virus, they get a little bit sick, but they're fine. So then why don't we let that group get the virus and protect everybody else? In theory, that works. In practice, it's super complicated in our society because how do you actually make sure that it's only 35-year-olds who are getting the virus and make sure that they're not actually in contact with others?
Dr. Sandro Galea is our guest. He's a physician, an epidemiologist, and the author of The Contagion Next Time, which takes a look at the underlying conditions that contributed to the ability of this virus to take hold here, and we'll talk about that when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Sandro Galea is our guest, an epidemiologist and the dean of the Boston University School of Public Health. He's also the author of a new book called The Contagion Next Time, and there will be another one, as epidemiologists have told us for a long time. In fact, the Obama administration, I alluded to this in the beginning of the program, had developed a playbook for how to handle a pandemic. It wasn't used. Are you familiar with that plan? And had it been used, would we have come out better?
Well, I am familiar with the plan, and there have been several plans that have been developed over time. And had we used any plan, it would have come out better. The truth is that we did not really use any plan that I recognize, that anybody recognizes, when this happened and it caught us unawares. And it became caught up, as we were discussing earlier, in a political maelstrom. And we threw things at the virus without any logic, rhyme, or reason. That was not entirely true. I mean, there were things that we did right away at the beginning that were very positive. For example, the seeding, the effort that became the vaccines, resulted in this extraordinary rapid development of efficacious, safe vaccines, faster than any vaccine we've ever developed, within 8 months from the initial infections in this country to vaccines being ready to go to market. That's remarkable. So those were steps that were taken early on in the pandemic that led to positives. Other positives were that our hospitals learned relatively quickly how to deal with sick people, that mortality in hospital, which at the beginning in March of 2020 was 20-25% mortality in hospital, dropped to under 3-4% in about 2 or 3 months. So our hospital system, a system in which we invest money, that responded very well early on. So there were things that we did well. I don't want to misstate. But some of the fundamentals, which is rapid testing, developing tests that quickly could tell us where there are cases of the virus, systems to test, trace, screen, isolate people who are positive in order to prevent the virus from becoming a pandemic throughout the country, those systems all failed.
Your book, The Contagion Next Time, you wrote a book about pandemics during a pandemic, while the pandemic continues to rage, but it's not really about all the things we've been talking about. It's really about conditions that have been with us for a long time, some of which are medical, some of which are not, that have led to this. You say that for many decades, the United States has let challenges grow and accumulate, and that when COVID arrived, you say that these years of neglect left us more vulnerable than we might otherwise have been. Give us some examples.
Yeah, the book is, you're correct, it's not as much about things we're talking about. The book is much more about the conditions that make us healthy. It's much more about safe housing, good schools, livable wages, gender equity, clean air, drinkable water, a fair economy. Now, for anyone listening, they might be thinking, wait a second, what does that have to do with the pandemic? So let's break it apart. The first part of that question is, well, what actually causes our health? And we often think that what causes our health are doctors and nurses and hospitals. But that's a misconception. Doctors like myself and nurses and hospitals are there to help us when we're sick. When we're sick, we want a good doctor, we want a good nurse, we want a good hospital. And as I said, remember, in the pandemic, hospitals did a good job of taking people who were already sick and restoring them to health. That's what hospitals and healthcare does. What makes us healthy is where we live, where we work, where we play. What makes us healthy is whether or not we're actually living in safe housing, whether or not there is a safe neighborhood for us to walk in or we're at risk of violence, whether or not we have livable wages that allow us to balance work and play, whether there is clean air, whether there is drinkable water. That is what keeps us healthy on a day-to-day basis. And those are the conditions in which we as a country underinvest. We as a country invest less money in those conditions. And as a result, we live sicker and shorter lives than all our other peer countries. And by peer countries, I mean high-income countries. We as a country have a life expectancy, this is before COVID, nothing to do with COVID, about 5 years less than other well-performing high-income countries, which if you think about it, is actually quite remarkable. It's really remarkable that we have a life expectancy that's 5 years shorter than other high-performing high-income countries. And this has been long before COVID. Now, you might say, okay, well, that's fine because we have other priorities. We spend more money on other things. We don't really care so much about health. But that's not true. We spend more than all other countries in the world on health. Per capita, we spend 30% to 40% more money on health than all other countries. So here's the paradox. Before COVID ever hit, as a country, we spend more on health than anybody else. And we have worse health outcomes than other high-income countries. And sometimes I challenge audiences to say, name one other sector where we accept spending more and getting less. I would argue that if our smartphones cost more, but they held less data, were slower, and had fuzzier screens than smartphones you can buy in other countries, nobody would buy smartphones. We are accustomed to the notion that you get what you pay for. And that's true for most things, but in health, we do not get what we pay for.
Well, explain that, because we've just done a series for a month-long series of programs on this program, and our news department has done a month-long series called The Price We Pay for Healthcare, which illustrates everything that you just talked about and takes it down to the level, it takes it out of the realm of healthcare and into the societal realm. If you live in a food desert, for instance, your access to healthy foods is not as abundant or affordable, perhaps, as because you don't have transportation options to get to affordable food as it would be elsewhere. So you eat what you can, and that leads to obesity. And we know that obese people were more affected by the COVID virus. So talk about why that is. Why do we put all the money in healthcare, which gives us worse outcomes than other countries, as opposed to putting it in society and taking away some of these conditions that lead to bad health?
You understand this beautifully. So you used the example of food and obesity. It's a perfect example. In the book, I used the term that we were sitting ducks for COVID-19. Why were we sitting ducks? We're sitting ducks because COVID-19 is a virus that affects people who are sicker much more than people who are not sicker. But we as a country were much sicker than we needed to be. We're more obese, we have more heart disease, we have more lung disease. All of those conditions, we have more than do other countries, which means that when we are infected with the virus, we're at much greater risk of getting sick. Now you ask me, why is that? You know, I think that's an excellent question. The truth is we weren't always like this. We've become more like this in the past 40 years or so. And when you look at life expectancy, just using that as a crude measure, you know, how long we live is a very crude measure, because not just about how long you live, it's also how well you live and all that. But we used to be comparable to other high-income countries in life expectancy until about the mid to late 80s. And then we have started losing steam. That shift coincided with us putting ever more money in healthcare and us devolving how we think about health from a collective responsibility to a personal responsibility. You know, I'll maybe use a metaphor, which I use in the book, which is the metaphor of firefighting. So in the book, I mentioned the metaphor. So firefighting has been with us for thousands of years. Firefighting, official firefighters emerged from the Roman Empire when the Romans realized they were building all these cities and they were burning down every once in a while. And firefighting didn't really change very much for a couple of thousand years. The firefighters would be there and they would be sitting around and waiting for a fire and then rush off and put out the fire. Well, about 50 years ago in this country, a very prominent fire chief said, well, this is a bit silly. What if we also became part of stopping fires from happening? So firefighters started getting involved in building inspections, establishing fire code, making sure fires don't break out. Today, we have half as many fires as we had 50 years ago. Now, we still have fires sometimes, so we still need firefighters. But surely we can all agree that it's a better country because we have fewer fires. Now, what did it take to do that? That took a mindset shift to say, our job is to prevent fires rather than just to put them out. So let's go back to health. Now, let's take this to health. We developed a mindset over the past 40 years, which we need to undo. And conversations like this, to my mind, are a step towards undoing them, where we pay all our attention to curing ourselves when we're sick, rather than thinking about how do we not get sick to begin with? How is it that we create a world that keeps us healthy? How do we create a world where everybody has safe housing? Because, of course, living in densely crowded, poorly ventilated housing is one of the conditions that resulted in the spread of the virus. How do we create conditions where everybody has access to food that is nutritious and not calorie dense so that we're less obese, so that we're less at risk of a virus like this? How do we create a system where there is a fair economy where people of all means can protect themselves when a virus happens? And, you know, I pick these three. I pick housing, I pick food, and I pick the economy, because those three had a direct impact on our experience with this virus. If you're living in a house which is crowded, poorly ventilated, you are going to get the virus more. If you're obese because of you've been eating poor food all your life because you haven't had access to good food, you are going to get sicker with the virus. And if you had a job that did not allow you the opportunity to distance yourself from others, particularly early on in the pandemic, you were more likely to get the virus. So these three things, housing, food, economy, all had very direct effects on how the virus affected us as a country.
Well, if we were on par with the rest of the world prior to the 1980s, what forces led to what you call the disinvestment in our social safety net?
Yeah, it's a complicated picture. Of course, what happened in the 80s is there was a real shift, which Ronald Reagan was elected president and represented a real shift towards more what's called neoliberal political thinking, which broadly speaking says that individuals are responsible for all good. So we started thinking of health as a personal good. We stopped thinking of health the way we think of, say, parks, education, the post office, fire stations, the environment. We recognize that parks are a shared property and we need to have public investment. And we started thinking of health as something that, Mike, you can buy and I can buy. But the mistake in the thinking is what we can really buy is sick care, not health. You know, I use another metaphor in a previous book, which is the example of parks, where we all can enjoy a park, but then it's like we have a shift in our thinking where it says, you know what? I don't really want to share this park with you. It's a park. I would like my own piece of the park. So let's all divide up the park and we all have our own parcel and go our own way. Well, if you did that, you take a public park, any public park near your home, and you think of it that way, well, you're going to end up with a little postage stamp size piece of park. Is it going to do you any good? No. I mean, you may say it's your postage stamp size piece of park, but it's much less useful to you than if there was a park that we can all share. It's the same with health. When you recognize that health is a product of the world around us, you recognize that it's not just about me buying my own health and you buying your own health. You recognize that it's a shared enterprise. It's a collective good, and it's a public good that we need to invest in collectively.
You're saying we have become a selfish, me-oriented society, not concerned with the general welfare, but only how well I'm doing. I got mine, you get yours, or be damned. That's essentially what you're saying.
Well, there are many things that are wrong with a me-oriented society that have nothing to do with health. But in the context of health, yes, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
I think there are many moral reasons why we might not want a me-oriented society. But in the context of health, the point is that approach harms our individual health. And what I'm hoping that the pandemic is a teachable moment for is before the pandemic, I think one could say, look, I may care about you because I'm a nice guy, but really what happens to you doesn't really affect what happens to my health. Well, what we saw in the pandemic all of a sudden is what happens to your health also matters for my health. All of a sudden we saw this very tangible example of how our health is interconnected. And the reason I wrote this book, you said I wrote a book about pandemic during a pandemic, because I see this as a teachable moment. It's a moment when we can learn that our health is interconnected, which I think can catalyze a new conversation about health, that we have not been able to have.
But what about those people who continually don't get the message you just talked about, that how what I do affects me, certainly, but it may also affect you, and that we should have that mutual concern for each other because what you do may affect me as well. So let's be good to each other. There are people out there who don't want to wear masks. There are people out there who don't want to get vaccinated.
So they haven't gotten that
message.
So I'm going to flip that on its head, because yes, it's true that there are people who don't want to wear masks. Yes, there are more people who don't want to get vaccinated. But you know what? The majority of people do wear masks in indoor spaces, and the majority of people do get vaccinated. You know, 99% of Americans over 65 have had at least one dose of vaccine. Now, you could look at that and say, well, we have about 70% of Americans over the age of 18 who've had one dose of vaccine. And you can say 30% haven't, or I can say, but 70% have. So yes, I think we spend a lot of time in the media conversation focusing on people who do not get it or who refuse to start thinking about health differently. I would like to actually flip the conversation and focus on the people, on the fact that the majority of Americans actually get this conversation. And I think that gives us the grounds for a sea change in how we think about health.
You've written that a culture of division stopped us from cohering around concern for the common good at a moment of historic crisis. All the social conditions and the politics prevented us from doing what we needed to do more quickly than we did it at the top of the pandemic. And that we should all be worried, because you say that since nothing has really changed, when the next spark comes, and it will come, there is no guarantee it will not be far worse than what we have just experienced. How many other health professionals, such as yourself, are concerned about that very thing?
I think all of them. I think any health professional recognizes that there may well be another pandemic. It is a cognitive error to say that because we had a pandemic in 2020, 2021, we're not going to have another one of a different variant in 2024. It's a human history has had waves of novel pathogens all throughout its human history. I mean, in times of Shakespeare, you read Shakespeare's plays and you see things like were shut down for years at a time because of novel pathogens. Mm-hmm. So we have gotten a little bit lulled into a sense of false security. The point I'm trying to make in the book is to say, we should create the healthiest world we possibly can in anticipation of the next pandemic. And you mentioned obesity, you mentioned things like heart disease. It should be a motivation to all of us to make sure that everybody has access to nutritious food in order that everybody's as healthy as possible. So when the next pandemic hits, you're going to have fewer people who get the virus, fewer people who have severe virus. And the time to do that is not when we have a pandemic. The time to do that is the time when we don't have a pandemic. I use in the book the metaphor of a ship going through a storm. And if you have a ship going through a storm and you have a hole in the hull, the time to fix the hole in the hull is not when you're in a storm. When you're in a storm, you hold on for dear life and you pray to God that you're going to get through the storm. The time to fix the hole in the hull is when you're in calm waters or we can get the boat out of water. But what we have done over the past few decades is we go through the storm, then the waters come down, the sun comes out, and we look at the hole in the hull and we say, well, it's above the waterline. It's not a big deal. Don't worry about it. We're going to be fine. And then next storm hits and I say, oh my goodness, we're going to sink. So I'm saying we recognize the hole. That's the hole as soon as we get through this pandemic.
I was going to ask you about the ship analogy because President Biden has this Build Back Better bill stalled in Congress at the moment. And I don't know how much of what's in that bill, if it passes, will address some of the concerns that we're talking about. But you write in your book about building a better ship and so that we'll be ready for the next pandemic. Explain why the ship analogy works and how it works, because you talk about the crew, you talk about the ship, you talk about the direction the vessel is headed. And I have about 45 seconds.
45 seconds. You have a ship, you have a captain, you have a crew, and you have the ship itself. The captain is leadership. The crew is the population, and the ship itself is our infrastructure. It's where we live, where we work, where we play. You need all three of those elements for a ship to make it through the storm. You need political leadership that makes wise decisions. You need a crew that is healthy before the storm hits. And you need a ship that is sound without having holes and cracks. And if you don't have one of those elements, you're going to have a much lower chance of getting through the storm.
In 5 seconds, how many of those elements do we have?
I think none.
Okay, we'll come back to that in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Sandro Galea is our guest. He's an epidemiologist, also the author of The Contagion Next Time, which talks about the social conditions that didn't do us well during this pandemic and some ways we can fix that for the next one when the next pandemic arrives, and it will. And you talked about the ship analogies just prior to the break where you need a leadership, you need a captain, you need a crew, that's us, that is healthy, and you need the vessel pointed in the right direction. And I asked you, which of those do we have? And you said none. Do you see any light at the end of that tunnel, to mix metaphors here? I mean, do you see any emerging?
I definitely see light at the end of the tunnel. I see, I think the very fact we're having this conversation gives me hope. That's the light at the end of the tunnel. And, saying none is obviously, it's a hard response, but I'm trying to focus our attention. I do think that we have political system that is so divided right now that has made it very difficult to have rational discussions about the trade-offs that one needs to make to deal with a pandemic like this. I do think that we have a population that lives sicker, shorter lives than other high-income countries. I do think that we have underinvested in public health. We have fewer public health workers than we had 10 years ago. Most counties in the U.S. spend less than $100 per person on public health. In most counties, in fact, we have larger police forces than we have public health. And so I think all of these are real challenges, and I think all three of them we need to fix. Now, do I think we will fix them? I do think we will. I have the optimism and the belief in this country of the immigrant, which is sometimes actually very helpful, because as an immigrant or as an adult, you choose to come to this country, and you choose to come to this country because you actually believe in its capacity to improve itself. And I really do. I actually really do. And I think that we will use this moment to learn. And the book was my small effort to help us learn.
Well, will we? Because you say in the book that we have the opportunity to do now what we didn't do in the aftermath of the SARS virus, and that is to build a world in which pandemics cannot emerge. In this country, as we've just talked about, we can't seem to do very much of anything, and not just medicine, anything, because we have at least one obstructive political party of science deniers, and another party struggling with their own internal battles. If we can't move forward on this, can the rest of the world? It's a global problem.
I would challenge the fact that we cannot, as a country, move on things. I think it's a mistake to think only of the national political picture in terms of thinking about innovation and action. I think there's a lot of really interesting innovation happening at the city, at the state level. I think there is a lot of innovation that will emerge eventually as the federal picture is led by municipal and state level action. So we as a country have shown that we can move on a whole host of issues. We have shown that the world, we can make the world a better place, because the truth is, it is a better world today than it was 50 years ago, and it's a better world than it was 100 years ago. We lurch in that direction. And how do we get to the direction? I think we get there through the marketplace of ideas that try to push us in that direction. Now, about the rest of the world, the rest of the world is obviously this one big, very heterogeneous construct. There are different countries which have their own different problems, and there are different countries that tackled aspects of this pandemic better than we did, and other countries that tackled aspects of the pandemic less well than we did. You know, I'm often asked, tell me the one country that did a great job. And the answer is, there is no one country, because different countries did a good job on different aspects. And of course, different countries look different, and they have different challenges than the ones we face.
Let me push back on one of the basic premises of this book a little bit, just to be fair and open
Please.
About this. You reference what happened during COVID, the height of COVID, during the shutdowns, and it brought unemployment to record levels, Great Depression levels for a period of time. It caused great hardship among many people, medically and otherwise. And it happened at a time when we also had civic unrest over the death of George Floyd, which brings up discussions of social inequities that date back centuries. Things like redlining, the effects of which still hang with us. Jim Crow, the effects of which still hang with us. Those are all problems in the United States. But this was a global pandemic that impacted people in other parts of the world that don't have these problems and that have better medical outcomes and cheaper coverage. And yet they suffered as much as we did. So how much of it is our fault? Are the structural vulnerabilities that you talk about really to blame?
Well, the empiric fact is actually they did not suffer as much as we did, because when you look at the data, we actually did worse than all other countries. So the data are pretty straightforward that we ended up doing worse than all the countries. Now, I'm not blaming all of that on these underlying conditions that you and I are talking about, because there is an element of idiosyncrasy, of luck, of randomness in how these viruses spread. But in our country, in this country, there is a very clear line where you can connect the dots between some of these injustices you've talked about and what happened with the pandemic. So let's take one concrete example. Let's take the black-white difference in death from the pandemic. So black Americans died at twice the rate of white Americans during the pandemic. Now that is at face value unjust, because the virus, just a set of spike proteins, it has nothing to do with the color of one's skin. So why did that happen? Well, it happened for two reasons. Number one, Black Americans had a higher rate of actually getting infected. And that was directly linked to economic opportunity and jobs that are occupied by people with lower wage categories that did not allow them to protect themselves by working from home. That, of course, is the product of centuries of marginalization, less wealth accumulation, less education, and being in worse occupational classes. That's one. The second is, when Black Americans got infected with the virus compared to white Americans, there was a higher severity, greater mortality rate. That is directly linked to underlying illness, hypertension, diabetes, heart disease. And that has marked black-white differences in health for decades and centuries, also linked to disenfranchisement, things like redlining, Jim Crow laws, all the way to slavery. So the history of the country, in this particular case, we're talking about black-white differences. I could also talk about Indigenous Americans, low-wage workers, people with less education. But just talking about this one comparison, The difference in this comparison is entirely had been written by the history of this country and by the fact that we haven't fully overcome this history. Now, to come back to your question about, well, is it all doom and gloom? My answer is, no, I don't think it's all doom and gloom. I think we have made enormous progress in the annals of dealing with structural racism in this country. Are we there yet? Absolutely not. But I think any objective observer will say that 2021, it's a better country to be in for mixing of different racial ethnic groups than it was in 1921. I mean, it's silly to say otherwise. So we have made progress, and I don't think it's a contradiction to say we have made progress, and there's a lot that we can do, and we should do more. And the pandemic illustrated that.
In fact, you begin the book by talking about how prior to the pandemic, we were living at a time when the world had never been better off or healthier than it was in 2020. And you envision building a world going forward that will be even better off and even healthier than before. Is that going to be accomplished merely by addressing the foundational deficiencies that you write about in this book, or is there more to it than that?
Well, I think addressing the foundational deficiencies will go a very long way. And in many respects, I don't think we can even see the opportunity that we have if we address the foundational deficiencies, because the history of the human species is one of ongoing continuous improvement that comes in fits and starts. There's discontinuities in it. But once we achieve a better level where we're better, we're healthier, we've dealt with these issues that we've talked about, we will then identify other ways in which we can improve. And we do that all the time with technologies that were previously unimaginable, because we get to ourselves in a place where now there's an opportunity for a next stage set of improvements. So I don't know if there will be other things that will improve, but I hope there will be.
You know, we were better off at the beginning of the 21st century than we were at the beginning of the 20th century in many different ways, including medically. And a lot of the medical advances are responsible for better health. And as you said, until the 1980s, we were as healthy as the rest of the world. And much of that came from the fact that we had developed not just cures and therapeutical approaches to things, but vaccines, which stopped smallpox and polio and other diseases that plagued mankind forever and led to great amounts of death. We can see this. We know this. We know we have these three vaccines for this pathogen. Why the reluctance? Do you understand the reluctance?
So I do and I don't. Let me start with the I do part. We have been reluctant to adopt new vaccines always in the history of vaccines. When the smallpox vaccine first came out, there were riots in the streets of London against the smallpox vaccine. And we often hold up polio as a triumph of vaccination. But in fact, it took 2 years and only about 67% of Americans were vaccinated against polio, which is a much slower pace than we've achieved right now. So in many respects, it's not a surprise. We have a history of, we as a world have a history of reluctance against vaccines. The second part of it is then, why is that? Well, a lot of that comes from lack of trust in systems. And when you have a system which you have not seen as working to your advantage, which you have not seen as providing you with a better life and better health, why should you suddenly trust that same system that comes to you and says, here, trust me, take this vaccine, it's good for you? To me, it's entirely rational for someone who has not felt like their health is improving, who has not felt like they actually have access to their resources to promote their health, to be skeptical of then a effort that says, for free, here's this vaccine, is good for your health. So I do think that there is an understandable reluctance, particularly from sectors of society which have not felt like the system is working for them before. And of course, you're going to ask me, how do we fix that? Well, we don't fix it during a pandemic. You fix that when we don't have a pandemic. You fix it by making sure that the system is working to promote everybody's health, so that then when a pandemic hits, everybody recognizes that there is a system that's going to say, here's the vaccine, and everybody's willing to trust it.
In this country didn't most of us didn't I don't think any of us lived through what life was like in 1901. I'm not sure there are very many people alive anymore who lived through 1901, but you spent some time talking about the early 20th century and the kind of conditions that people lived in and how a young person who living in poverty in the beginning of the 20th century was very different from somebody living in the 21st century, and how a lot of that is because of social forces that have come into play. A relatively peaceful world. Those people, children in 1901, lived through, if they lived, they lived through two world wars. They lived through an unstable economy. They lived through the Great Depression. We have a better, for all its faults, social safety net today than they had then, and that's allowed people to live better lives, even if they live in poverty. And you say the same forces in place in the early 20th century, however, are just as influential in our own time. So we're better off, but we're not good enough. Is that a growing opinion among most public health officials?
I think so. I do think that public health has entered this phase in its history. And Dr. Karen DeSalvo, who was in the federal government for a long time, used this term public health 3.0. And the notion is that public health is both coming back to its roots, but also looking forward. And by coming back to its roots, it means that public health professionals recognize that the key to health is the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat, the conditions that create that air, food, and water, whether we have opportunities to exercise or not, whether we have opportunities to live in a safe environment or not. And public health has recognized that, which is actually going back to our roots, to going back to 100 years ago. But seeing this as an opportunity to then infuse that into all sectors and to make that a foundation for other more high-tech approaches in public health, which include, of course, the type of testing, screening, isolation that one wants to have as an infrastructure to limit the spread of a novel pathogen.
Your book is about societal factors, not necessarily medical ones, but your prescription, in addition to being a societal one, it involves healthcare being a right. And not a privilege, but many people in this country believe in self-reliance and individualism, it's hard to break that mold. You also say we need compassion.
Yes.
Are we, in your opinion, a compassionate country?
I think we are a compassionate country and can be much better. And by the reason I talk about compassion is because compassion means it requires us wanting each other to do better for no reason other than our shared humanity. It means it's not about empathy, which means I want you to be better because I can see the world through your eyes. No, I want you to be better and healthier just because you and I are fellow human beings. And to go to the point you made about people in this country who believe in self-reliance, I also believe in self-reliance. But I also want to make sure there's a fire department that's available, that's publicly funded, that can come put out a fire if there's a fire in my house. I would challenge us to find anybody who says, my self-reliant means that I will put out my own fire. I mean, maybe there are some people, but it's on the extremes. And really, this is a very simple point, which is I want to make sure that we understand that our health is not that different than the fire, that our health is interconnected, and we need to invest in the structures that help our health, that it's not good enough to do it yourself, that you yourself cannot do your health alone.
You say that in the early days of the pandemic, because you had time on your hands, you spent a lot of time listening to podcasts about world history and the causes of the French Revolution and the central cause of the fall of the Roman Empire. And you say that historians are still arguing over the causes for that. But you have written this book about pandemics during a pandemic, about what went wrong and the underlying causes of the pandemic and what we can do to correct them. Many would say you can't see the forest for the trees. These historians are looking back 2,000 years. You're looking back 20 minutes. How do you know you're right? We have 30 seconds. How do you know you're right?
Yeah, I don't know I'm right, but the reason I wrote this book is because I knew that there was going to be a lot of discussion about vaccines and about therapeutics and about stockpiles and all that. And all that's very important. But I wanted to start this conversation. And I want other people to write books that are righter than mine. Okay. My goal was to catalyze these ideas.
Dr. Sandra Galea, physician, epidemiologist, dean, and a professor in the Department of Public Health at Boston University School of Public Health, and the author of The Contagion Next Time. Thank you for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.